and the regency had offered little change, for the memories of King Aenys's time were painful to his widow, whilst Lord Rogar was of a martial temperament, and once declared mummers to be of less use than monkeys, for they both prance about, tumble, caper, and squeal, but if a man is hungry enough, he can eat a monkey. Queen Alysanne looked back on the short-lived glories of her father's court fondly, however, and made it her purpose to make the Red Keep glitter as it never had before, buying tapestries and carpets from free cities, and commissioning murals, statuary, and tilework to decorate the castle's halls and chambers. At her command, men from the city watch combed Flea Bottom until they found Tom the Strummer, whose mocking songs had amused king and commons alike during the war for the White Cloaks. Alysanne made him the court singer, the first of many who would hold that office in the decades to come. She brought in a harpist from Old Town, a company of mummers from Braavos, dancers from Lys, and gave the Red Keep its first fool, a fat man called the Goodwife, who dressed as a woman and was never seen without his wooden children, a pair of cleverly carved puppets who said ribald, shocking things. All this pleased King Jaehaerys, but none of it pleased him half so much as the gift that Queen Alysanne gave him several moons later, when she told him she was with child. Birth, Death, and Betrayal under King Jaehaerys I. Jaehaerys I Targaryen would prove to be as restless a king as ever sat the Iron Throne. Aegon the Conqueror had famously said that the small folk needed to see their kings and queens from time to time, so they might lay their griefs and grievances before them. "I mean for them to see me," Jaehaerys declared when announcing his first royal progress late in 51 AC. Many more were to follow in the years and decades to come. During the course of his long reign, Jaehaerys would spend more days and nights guesting with one lord or another, or holding audience in some market town or village, than at Dragonstone and the Red Keep combined. And oft as not, Alysanne was with him, her silvery dragon soaring beside his great beast of burnished bronze. Aegon the Conqueror had been accustomed to taking as many as 1,000 knights, men-at-arms, grooms, cooks, and other servants with him on the road. Whilst undeniably grand to behold, such processions created many difficulties for the lords honoured by royal visits. So many men were difficult to house and feed, and if the king wished to go hunting, nearby woods would be overrun. Even the richest lord would oft find himself impoverished by the time the king departed, his cellars drunk dry of wine, his larders empty, and half his maidservants with bastards in their bellies. Jaehaerys was resolved to do things differently. No more than 100 men would accompany him on any progress, 20 knights, the rest men-at-arms and servants. "I do not need to ring myself about with swords, so long as I ride Vermithor," he said. Smaller numbers also allowed him to visit smaller lords, those whose castles had never been large enough to host Aegon. His intent was to see and be seen at more places, but stay at each a shorter time so as never to become an unwelcome guest. The king's first progress was meant to be a modest one, commencing with the Crownlands north of King's Landing, and proceeding only as far as the Vale of Arryn. Jaehaerys wanted Alysanne with him, but as her grace was with child, he was concerned that their journeys not be too taxing. They began with Stokeworth and Rosby, then moved north along the coast to Duskendale. There, whilst the king viewed Lord Darklyn's boatyards and enjoyed an afternoon of fishing, the queen held the first of her women's courts, which were to become an important part of every royal progress to come. Only women and girls were welcome at these audiences. High-born or low, they were encouraged to come forward and share their fears, concerns, and hopes with the young queen. The journey went without incident until the king and queen reached Maidenpool, where they were to be the guests of Lord and Lady Mouton for a fortnight, before sailing across the Bay of Crabs to Wickenden, Gulltown, and the Vale. The town of Maidenpool was far famed for the Sweetwater Pool, where legend had it that Florian the Fool had first glimpsed Jonquil bathing during the Age of Heroes. Like thousands of other women before her, Queen Alysanne wished to bathe in Jonquil's pool, whose waters were said to have amazing healing properties. The lords of Maidenpool had erected a great stone bathhouse around the pool many centuries before, and given it over to an order of holy sisters. No men were allowed to enter the premises, so when the queen slipped into the sacred waters, she was attended only by her ladies-in-waiting, maids and septas. Edith and Lyra, who had served beside Septa Isabel as novices, had both recently sworn their vows to become septas, consecrated in the faith and devoted to the queen. The goodness of the little queen, the silence of the starry sept, and the exhortations of the seven speakers had won over most of the faithful for Jaehaerys and his Alysanne, but there are always some who will not be moved. And amongst the sisters who tended Jonquil's pool were three such women, whose hearts were hard with hate. They told one another that their holy waters would be polluted forever, were the queen allowed to bathe in them whilst carrying the king's abomination in her belly. Queen Alysanne had only slipped out of her clothing when they fell upon her with daggers they had concealed within their robes. Blessedly, the attackers were no warriors, and they had not taken the courage of the queen's companions into account. Naked and vulnerable, the wise women did not hesitate, but stepped between the attackers and their lady. Septa Edith was slashed across the face. Prudence Celtigar stabbed through the shoulder, whilst Rosamond Ball took a dagger in the belly that, 3 days later, proved to be the death of her. But none of the murderous blades touched the queen. The shouts and screams of the struggle brought Alysanne's protectors running, for Sir Geoffrey Doggett and Sir Giles Morrigan had been guarding the entrance to the bathhouse, never dreaming that the danger lurked within. The king's guard made short work of the attackers, slaying two out of hand whilst keeping the third alive for questioning. When encouraged, she revealed that half a dozen others of their order had helped plan the attack, whilst lacking the courage to wield a blade. Lord Mouton hanged the guilty, and might have hanged the innocent as well, save for Queen Alysanne's intervention. Jaehaerys was furious. Their visit to the Vale was postponed. Instead, they returned to the safety of Maegor's holdfast. Queen Alysanne would remain within until her child was born, but the experience had shaken her and set her to pondering. "I need a protector of mine own," she told His Grace. "Your seven are leal men and valiant, but they are men, and there are places men cannot go." The king could not disagree. A raven flew to Duskendale that very night, commanding the new Lord Darklyn to send to court his bastard half-sister, Jonquil Dark, who had thrilled the small folk during the war for the White Cloaks as the mystery knight known as the Serpent in Scarlet. Still in Scarlet, she arrived at King's Landing a few days later, and gladly accepted appointment as the Queen's own sworn shield. In time she would be known about the realm as the Scarlet Shadow, so closely did she guard her lady. Not long after Jaehaerys and Alysanne returned from Maidenpool and the Queen took to her bedchamber, tidings of the most wondrous and unexpected sort came forth from Storm's End. Queen Alyssa was with child. At 44 years of age, the Dowager Queen had been thought to be well beyond her childbearing years, so her pregnancy was received as a miracle. In Old Town, the High Septon himself proclaimed it was a blessing from the gods, a gift from the Mother above to a mother who had suffered much and bravely. Amidst the joy, there was concern as well. Alyssa was not as strong as she had been. Her time as Queen Regent had taken a toll on her, and her second marriage had not brought her the happiness she had once hoped for. The prospect of a child warmed Lord Rogar's heart, however, and he cast off his anger and repented of his infidelities to stay by his wife's side. Alyssa herself was fearful, mindful of the last babe she had borne to King Aenys, the little girl Vela, who had died in the cradle. "I cannot suffer that again," she told her lord husband. "It would rip my heart apart." But the child, when he came early the following year, would prove to be robust and healthy, a big, red-faced boy born with a fuzz of jet-black hair and a squall that could be heard from dawn to the wall. Lord Rogar, who had long ago put aside any hopes of having children by Alyssa, named his son Boromund. The gods give grief as well as joy. Long before her mother was brought to term, Queen Alysanne was also delivered of a son, a boy she named Aegon, to honour both the conqueror and her lost and much-lamented brother, the uncrowned prince. All the realm gave thanks, and no one more so than Jaehaerys. But the young prince had come too early. Small and frail, he died 3 days after birth. So bereft was Queen Alisande that the maesters feared for her life as well. Forever after, she blamed her son's death on the women who attacked her at Maidenpool. Had she been allowed to bathe in the healing waters of Jonquil's pool, she would say, Prince Aegon would have lived. Discontent lay heavy upon Dragonstone as well, where Rhaenyra Targaryen had established her own small court. As they had with Jaehaerys before her, neighbouring lords began to seek her out. But the queen in the east was not her brother. Many of her visitors were received coldly, others turned away without an audience. Queen Rhaenyra's reunion with her daughter Arya had not gone well, either. The princess had no memory of her mother, and the queen no knowledge of her child, nor any fondness for the children of others. Arya had loved the excitement of the Red Keep, with lords and ladies and envoys from queer foreign lands coming and going, knights training in the yards every morning, singers and mummers and fools capering by night, and all the clangour and colour and tumult of King's Landing just beyond the walls. She had loved the attention lavished on her as the heir to the Iron Throne as well. Great lords, gallant knights, bedmaids, washerwomen, and stable boys alike had praised her, loved her, and vied for her favour. And she had been the leader of a pack of young girls of both high and low birth who had terrorised the castle. All that had been taken from her when her mother carried her off to Dragonstone against her wishes. Compared to King's Landing, the island was a dull place, sleepy and quiet. There were no girls of her own age in the castle, and Arya was not allowed to mingle with the daughters of the fisherfolk in the village beneath the walls. Her mother was a stranger to her, sometimes stern and sometimes shy, much given to brooding, and the women who surrounded her seemed to take little interest in Arya. Of all of them, the only one the princess warmed to was Elissa Farman of Fair Isle, who told her tales of her adventures and promised to teach her how to sail. Lady Elissa was no happier on Dragonstone than Arya herself, however. She missed her wide western seas and spoke often of returning to them. "Take me with you," Princess Arya would say when she did, and Elissa Farman would laugh. Dragonstone did have one thing King's Landing largely lacked: dragons. In the great citadel under the shadow of the Dragonmont, more dragons were being born every time the moon turned, or so it seemed. The eggs that Dreamfire had laid on Fair Isle had all hatched once on Dragonstone, and Rhaena Targaryen had made certain that her daughter made their acquaintance. "Choose one and make him yours," the queen urged the princess, "and one day you will fly." There were older dragons in the yards as well, and beyond the walls, wild dragons that had escaped the castle made their lairs in hidden caves on the far side of the mountain. Princess Arya had known Vermithor and Silverwing during her time at court, but she had never been allowed too close to them. Here she could visit with the dragons as often as she liked, the hatchlings, the young drakes, her mother's Dreamfire, and greatest of them all, Balerion and Vhagar, huge and ancient and sleepy, but still terrifying when they woke and stirred and spread their wings. In the Red Keep, Arya had loved her horse, her hounds, and her friends. On Dragonstone, the dragons became her friends, her only friends aside from Elissa Farman, and she began to count the days until she could mount one and fly far, far away. King Jaehaerys finally made his progress through the Vale of Arryn in 52 AC, calling at Gulltown, Runestone, Redfort, Longbow Hall, Hart's Home, and the Gates of the Moon, before flying Vermithor up the Giant's Lance to the Eyrie, as Queen Visenya had done during the conquest. Queen Alysanne accompanied him for part of his travels, but not all. She had not yet recovered her full strength after childbirth and the grief that followed. Still, by her good offices, the betrothal of Lady Prudence Celtigar to Lord Grafton of Gulltown was arranged. Her Grace also held a women's court at Gulltown, and a second at the Gates of the Moon. What she heard and learned would change the laws of the Seven Kingdoms. Men oft speak today of Queen Alysanne's laws, but this usage is sloppy and incorrect. Her Grace had no power to enact laws, issue decrees, make proclamations, or pass sentences. It is a mistake to speak of her as we might speak of the conquerors, queens, Rhaenys and Visenya. The young queen did, however, wield enormous influence over King Jaehaerys, and when she spoke, he listened, as he did upon their return from the Vale of Arryn. It was the plight of widows throughout the Seven Kingdoms that the women's courts had made Alysanne aware of. In times of peace especially, it was not uncommon for a man to outlive the wife of his youth, for young men most oft perish upon the battlefield, young women in the birthing bed. Be they of noble birth or humble, men left bereft, suchwise, would oft after a time take second wives, whose presence in the household was resented by the children of the first wife. Where no bonds of affection existed, upon the man's own death his heirs could, and did, expel the widow from the home, reducing her to penury. In the case of lords, the heirs might simply strip away the widow's prerogatives, incomes, and servants, reducing her to little more than a boarder. To rectify these ills, King Jaehaerys, in 52 AC, promulgated the widow's law, reaffirming the right of the eldest son, or eldest daughter, where there was no son, to inherit, but requiring said heirs to maintain surviving widows in the same condition they had enjoyed before their husband's death. A lord's widow, be she a second, third, or later wife, could no longer be driven from his castle, nor deprived of her servants, clothing, and income. The same law, however, also forbade men from disinheriting their children by a first wife in order to bestow their lands, seat, or property upon a later wife or her own children. Building was the king's other concern that year. Work continued on the Dragon Pit, and Jaehaerys oft visited the site to see the progress with his own eyes. Whilst riding from Aegon's high hill to the Hill of Rhaenys, however, his grace took note of the most lamentable state of his city. King's Landing had grown too fast, with manses and shops and hovels and rat pits springing up like mushrooms after a hard rain. The streets were close and dark and filthy, with buildings so close to one another that men could clamber from one window to another. The wynds coiled about like drunken snakes. Mud, manure, and night soil were everywhere. "Would that I could empty the city, knock it down, and build it all anew," the king told his council. Lacking that power, and the coin such a massive undertaking would have required, Jaehaerys did what he could. Streets were widened, straightened, and cobbled, where possible. The worst sties and hovels were torn down. A great central square was carved out and planted with trees, with markets and arcades beneath. From that hub, long, wide streets sprung, straight as spears, the King's Way, the God's Way, the Street of the Sisters, Blackwater Way, or the Muddy Way, as the small folk soon renamed it. None of this could be accomplished in a night. Work would continue for years, even decades. But it was the year 52 AC when it began, by the king's command. The cost of rebuilding the city was not inconsequential, and put further strain upon the crown's treasury. Those difficulties were exacerbated by the growing unpopularity of the Lord of Air, Rigo Draz. In a short time, the Pentosian master of coin had become as widely loathed as his predecessor, though for different reasons. He was said to be corrupt, taking the king's gold to fatten his own purse, a charge Lord Rigo treated with derision. "Why should I steal from the king? I am twice as rich as he is." He was said to be godless, for he did not worship the Seven. Many a queer god is worshipped in Pentos, but Draz was known to keep but one, a small household idol, like unto a woman great with child, with swollen breasts and a bat's head. "She is all the god I need," was all he would say upon the matter. He was said to be a mongrel, an assertion he could not deny, for all Pentosia, part Andal and part Valyrian, mixed with a stock of slaves and older peoples long forgotten. Most of all, he was resented for his wealth, which he did not deign to conceal, but flaunted with his silken robes, ruby rings, and gilded palanquin. That Lord Rigo Draz was an able master of coin, even his enemies could not deny, but the challenge of paying for the completion of the Dragon Pit and the rebuilding of King's Landing strained even his talents. The taxes on silk, spice, and crenellations alone could not answer, so Lord Rigo reluctantly imposed a new levy, a gate fee, required of anyone entering or leaving the city, collected by the guards on the city's gates. Additional fees were assessed for horses, mules, donkeys and oxen, and wagons and carts were taxed heaviest of all. Given the amount of traffic that came and went from King's Landing every day, the gate tax proved to be highly lucrative, bringing in more than enough coin to meet the need, but at considerable cost to Rigo Draz himself, as the grumbling against him increased tenfold. A long summer, plentiful harvests, and peace and prosperity both at home and abroad helped to blunt the edge of the discontent, however, and as the year drew to a close, Queen Alisanne brought the king splendid news. Her grace was once again with child. This time she vowed no enemies would come near her. Plans for a second royal progress had already been made and announced before the queen's condition became known. Though Jaehaerys decided at once that he would remain by his wife's side until the babe was born, Alisanne would not have it. He must go, she insisted. And so he did. The coming of the new year saw the king taking to the sky again on Vermithor, this time for the Riverlands. His progress began with a stay at Harrenhal as a guest of its new lord, the 9-year-old Maegor Towers. From there he and his retinue moved on to Riverrun, Acorn Hall, Pink Maiden, Atranta, and Stony Sept. At his queen's request, Lady Jenys Templeton travelled with the king to hold women's courts at Riverrun and Stony Sept in her place. Alisanne remained in the Red Keep, presiding over council meetings in the king's absence and holding audience from a velvet seat at the base of the Iron Throne. As her grace grew great with child, just across Blackwater Bay, by the gullet, another woman was delivered of another child, whose birth, whilst less noted, would in time be of great significance to the lands of Westeros and the seas that lay beyond. On the Isle of Driftmark, Daemon Valerian's eldest son became a father for the first time when his lady wife presented him with a handsome, healthy boy. The babe was named Corlys, after the great-great-uncle who had served so nobly as the Lord Commander of the First Kingsguard. But in the years to come, the people of Westeros would come to know this new Corlys better as the Sea Snake. The Queen's own child followed in due course. She was brought to bed during the 7th moon of 53 AC, and this time she gave birth to a strong and healthy child, a girl she named Daenerys. The king was at Stony Sept when word reached him. He mounted Vermithor and flew back to King's Landing at once. Though Jaehaerys had hoped for another son to follow him upon the Iron Throne, it was plain that he doted on his daughter from the moment he first took her in his arms. The realm delighted in the little princess as well. Everywhere, that is, save on Dragonstone. Arya Targaryen, the daughter of Aegon the Uncrowned and his sister Rhaena, was 11 years of age and had been heir to the Iron Throne for as long as she could remember, but for the 3 days that separated Prince Aegon's birth from his death. A strong-willed, bold-tongued, fiery young girl, Arya delighted in the attention that came with being a queen-in-waiting, and was not pleased to find herself displaced by the newborn princess. Her mother, Queen Rhaena, likely shared these feelings, but she held her tongue and spoke no word of it, even to her closest confidants. She had trouble enough in her own hall at the time, for a rift had opened between her and her beloved Alyssa Farman. Denied any part of the incomes of Fair Isle by her brother Lord Franklin, Alyssa asked the Dowager Queen for gold sufficient to build a new ship in the shipyards of Driftmark, a large, swift vessel meant to sail the Sunset Sea. Rhaena denied her request. "I could not bear for you to leave me," she said. But Lady Alyssa heard only, "No." With the hindsight of history to guide us, we can look back and see that all the portents were there, ominous signs of difficult days ahead. But even the Archmaesters of the Conclave saw none of that as they reflected on the year about to end. Not one of them realized that the year ahead would be amongst the darkest in the long reign of Jaehaerys I Targaryen, a year so marked by death, division, and disaster that the maesters and small folk alike would come to call it the Year of the Stranger. The first death of 54 AC came within days of the celebrations that marked the coming of the new year, as Septon Oswyck passed in his sleep. He was an old man and had been failing for some time, but his passing cast a pall over the court all the same. At a time when the Queen Regent, the King's Hand, and the Faith had all opposed the marriage of Jaehaerys and Alysanne, Oswyck had agreed to perform the rites for them, and his courage had not been forgotten. At the King's request, his remains were interred on Dragonstone, where he had served so long and so faithfully. The Red Keep was still in mourning when the next blow fell, though at the time it seemed an occasion for joy. A raven from Storm's End delivered an astonishing message. Queen Alysa was once again with child at the age of 46. "A second miracle," Grand Maester Benefer proclaimed when he told the king the news. Septon Barth, who had taken on Oswyck's duties after his death, was more doubtful. Her grace had never completely recovered from the birth of her son Boromund, he cautioned. He questioned whether she still had strength enough to carry a child to term. Rhaegar Baratheon was elated at the prospect of another son, however, and foresaw no difficulties. His wife had given birth to 7 children, he insisted. Why not an 8th? On Dragonstone, problems of another sort were coming to a head. Lady Alysa Farman could suffer life upon the island no more. She had heard the sea calling, she told Queen Rhaena. It was time for her to take her leave. Never one to make a show of her emotions, the Queen in the East received the news stone-faced. "I have asked you to stay," she said. "I will not beg. If you would go, go." Princess Arya had none of her mother's restraint. When Lady Alysa came to say her farewells, the princess wept and clung to her leg, pleading with her to stay, or failing that, to take her along. "I want to be with you," Arya said. "I want to sail the seas and have adventures." Lady Alysa shed a tear as well, we are told, but she pushed the princess away gently and told her, "No, child, your place is here." Alysa Farman departed for Driftmark the next morning. From there she took ship across the narrow sea to Pentos. Thereafter she made her way overland to Braavos, whose shipwrights were far famed, but Rhaena Targaryen and Princess Arya had no notion of her final destination. The Queen believed she had gone no farther than Driftmark. Lady Alysa had good reason for wanting more distance between her and the Queen, however. A fortnight after her departure, Sir Meryl Bullock, still commander of the castle garrison, brought 3 terrified grooms and the keeper of the dragon yard into Rhaena's presence. 3 dragon eggs were missing, and days of searching had not turned them up. After questioning every man who had access to the dragons closely, Sir Meryl was convinced that Lady Alysa had made off with them. If this betrayal by one she had loved wounded Rhaena Targaryen, she hid it well, but there was no hiding her fury. She commanded Sir Meryl to question the grooms and stable boys more sharply. When the questioning proved fruitless, she relieved him of his command and expelled him from Dragonstone, together with his son, Sir Alyn, and a dozen other men she found suspicious. She even went so far as to summon her husband, Andro Farman, demanding to know if he had been complicit in his sister's crime. His denials only goaded her to more rage, until their shouts could be heard echoing through the halls of Dragonstone. She sent men to Driftmark, only to learn that Lady Alysa had sailed to Pentos. She sent men to Pentos, but there the trail went cold. Only then did Rhaena Targaryen mount Dreamfire to fly to the Red Keep and inform her brother of what had transpired. "Alysa had no love for dragons," she told the king. "It was gold she wanted, gold to build a ship. She will sell the eggs. They are worth a fleet of ships." Jaehaerys had received his sister in his sola, with only Grand Maester Benefer present to bear witness to what was said. "If those eggs should hatch, there will be another dragon lord in the world, one not of our own house." "They may not hatch," Benefer said. "Not away from Dragonstone. The heat. It is known some dragon eggs simply turn to stone." "Then some spicemonger in Pentos will find himself possessed of 3 very costly stones," Jaehaerys said. "Elsewise, the birth of 3 young dragons is not a thing that can easily be kept secret. Whoever has them will want to crow. We must have eyes and ears in Pentos, Tyrosh, Myr, all the free cities. Offer rewards for any word of dragons." "What do you mean to do?" his sister Rhaena asked him. "What I must, what you must. Do not think to wash your hands of this, sweet sister. You wanted Dragonstone, and I gave it to you, and you brought this woman there, this thief. The long reign of Jaehaerys I Targaryen was a peaceful one, for the most part. Such wars as he fought were few and short. Let no man mistake Jaehaerys for his father Aenys, however. There was nothing weak about him, nothing indecisive. As his sister Rhaena and Grand Maester Bennifer witnessed then, when the king went on to say, "Should the dragons turn up, anywhere from here to Yi Ti, we will demand their return. They were stolen from us, they are ours by right. If that demand should be denied, then we must needs go and get them. Take them back if we can, kill them if not. No hatchlings can hope to stand against Vermithor and Dreamfire." "And Silverwing?" asked Rhaena. "Our sister had no part in this. I will not put her at risk." The queen in the east smiled then. "She is Rhaenys, and I am Visenya. I have never thought otherwise." Grand Maester Bennifer said, "You are speaking of waging war across the narrow sea, your grace. The costs must needs be borne. I will not allow Valyria to rise again. Imagine what the Triarchs of Volantis would do with dragons. Let us pray it never comes to that." With that, his grace ended the audience, cautioning the others not to speak of the missing eggs. "No one must know of this but we three." It was too late for such cautions, though. On Dragonstone the theft was common knowledge, even amongst the fisherfolk. And fisherfolk, as is known, sailed to other islands, and thus the whispers spread. Bennifer, acting through the Pentoshe Master of Coin, who had agents in every port, reached out across the narrow sea as the king had commanded, "paying good coin to bad men," in the words of Rigo Draz, "for any news of dragon eggs, dragons, or Elissa Farman." A small host of whisperers, informers, courtiers, and courtesans produced hundreds of reports, a score of which proved to be of value to the Iron Throne for other reasons, but every rumour of the dragon eggs proved worthless. We know now that Lady Elissa made her way to Braavos after Pentos, though not before taking on a new name. Having been driven from Fair Isle and disowned by her brother Lord Franklin, she took on a bastard name of her own devising, calling herself Alice Westhill. Under that name she secured an audience with the Sea Lord of Braavos. The Sea Lord's menagerie was far famed, and he was glad to buy the dragon eggs. The gold she received in return she entrusted to the Iron Bank, and used it to finance the building of the Sun Chaser, the ship she had dreamed of for many a year. None of this was known on Westeros at the time, however, and soon enough King Jaehaerys had a fresh concern. In the Starry Sept of Old Town, the High Septon had collapsed whilst ascending a flight of steps to his bedchamber. He was dead before he reached the bottom. All across the realm, bells in every sept sang a dolorous song. The Father of the Faithful had gone to join the Seven. The king had no time for prayer or grieving, though. As soon as His Holiness was interred, the most devout would be assembling in the Starry Sept to choose his successor. And Jaehaerys knew that the peace of the realm depended on the new man continuing the policies of his predecessor. The king had his own candidate for the Crystal Crown, Septon Barth, who had come to oversee the Red Keep's library, only to become one of his most trusted advisers. It took half the night for Barth himself to persuade his grace of the folly of his choice. He was too young, too little known, too unorthodox in his opinions, not even one of the most devout. He had no hope of being chosen. They would need another candidate, one more acceptable to his brothers of the faith. The king and the lords of the council were agreed on one thing, however. They must needs do all they could to make certain that Septon Mateus was not chosen. His tenure in King's Landing had left a legacy of mistrust behind it, and Jaehaerys could neither forgive nor forget his words at the gates of Dragonstone. Rigo Draz suggested that some well-placed bribes might produce the desired result. "Spread enough gold amongst these most devout, and they will choose me," he japed, "though I would not want the job." Daemon Valerian and Carl Corbray advocated a show of force, though Lord Daemon wished to send his fleet, whilst Lord Carl offered to lead an army. Albin Massey, The bent-backed master of laws wondered if Septon Mateus might suffer the same fate as the High Septon who had made such trouble for Aenys and Magor, a sudden, mysterious death. Septon Barth, Grand Maester Benefer and Queen Alysanne were horrified by all these proposals, and the king rejected them out of hand. He and the queen would go to Old Town at once, he decided instead. His High Holiness had been a leal servant to the gods and a staunch friend to the Iron Throne. It was only right that they be there to see him laid to rest. The only way to reach Old Town in time was by dragon. All the lords of the council, even Septon Barth, were made uneasy by the thought of the king and queen alone in Old Town. "There are still those amongst my brothers who do not love your grace," Barth pointed out. Lord Daemon agreed and reminded Jaehaerys of what had befallen the queen at Maidenpool. When the king insisted that he would have the protection of the High Tower, uneasy glances were exchanged. "Lord Donal is a schemer and a sulker," said Manfred Redwine. "I do not trust him, nor should you. He does what he thinks best for himself, his house, and Old Town, and cares not a fig for anyone or anything else, not even for his king." "Then I must convince him that what is best for his king is what is best for himself, his house, and Old Town," said Jaehaerys. "I believe I can do that." So he ended the discussion and gave orders for their dragons to be brought forth. Even for a dragon, the flight from King's Landing to Old Town is a long one. The king and queen stopped twice along the way, once at Bitterbridge and once at Highgarden, resting overnight and taking counsel with their lords. The lords of the council had insisted that they take some protection at the very least. Sir Geoffrey Doggett flew with Alysanne, and the Scarlet Shadow, Jonquil Dark, with Jaehaerys, so as to balance the weight each dragon carried. The unexpected arrival of Vermithor and Silverwing at Old Town brought thousands to the streets to point and stare. No word of their coming had been sent ahead, and there were many in the city who were frightened, wondering what this might portend. None, mayhaps, more than Septon Mateus, who turned pale when he was told. Jaehaerys brought down Vermithor on the wide marble plaza outside the Starry Sept. But it was his queen who made the city gasp when Silverwing alighted atop the High Tower itself, the beating of her wings fanning the flames of its famous beacon. Though the High Septon's funeral rites were the purported reason for their visit, his High Holiness had already been interred in the crypts beneath the Starry Sept by the time the king and queen arrived. Jaehaerys gave a eulogy nonetheless, addressing a huge crowd of septons, maesters, and small folk in the plaza. At the end of his remarks, he announced that he and the queen would remain in Old Town until the new High Septon had been chosen, so we might ask for his blessing. As Archmaester Goodwin wrote afterward, the small folk cheered, the maesters nodded sagely, and the septons looked at one another and thought on dragons. During their time in Old Town, Jaehaerys and Alysanne slept in Lord Donal's own apartments at the top of the High Tower, with all of Old Town spread out below. We have no certain knowledge of what words passed between them and their host, for their discussions took place behind closed doors, without even a maester present. Years later, however, King Jaehaerys told Septon Barth all that occurred, and Barth set down a summary for the sake of history. The High Towers of Old Town were an ancient family, powerful, wealthy, proud, and large. It had long been their custom for the younger sons, brothers, cousins, and bastards of the house to join the faith, where many had risen high over the centuries. Lord Donal Hightower had a younger brother, two nephews, and six cousins serving the Seven in 54 AC. The brother, one nephew, and two cousins wore the cloth of silver of the most devout. It was Lord Donald's desire that one of them become High Septon. King Jaehaerys did not care which house his High Holiness derived from, or whether he was of low or noble birth. His only concern was that the new High Septon be an exceptionalist. The Targaryen tradition of sibling marriage must never again be questioned by the Starry Sept. He wanted the new Father of the Faithful to make exceptionalism an official doctrine of the faith. And though His Grace had no objection to Lord Donald's brother, nor the rest of his ilk, none of them had yet spoken on the issue. So, After hours of discussion, an understanding was reached, and sealed with a great feast wherein Lord Donald praised the wisdom of the king, whilst making him acquainted with his brothers, uncles, nephews, nieces, and cousins. Across the city at the Starry Sept, the most devout convened to choose their new shepherd, with agents of Lord Hightower and the king amongst them, unbeknownst to most. 4 ballots were required. Septon Mateus led on the first, as anticipated, but lacked the votes necessary to secure the crystal crown. Thereafter his numbers dwindled on every ballot, whilst other men rose up. On the 4th ballot, the most devout broke tradition, choosing a man who was not one of their own number. The laurel fell to the Septon Alfin, who had crossed the reach 12 times in his litter on behalf of Jaehaerys and his queen. The 7 kingdoms had no fiercer champion of exceptionalism than Alfin, but he was the oldest of the 7 speakers, and legless besides. It seemed likely the stranger would seek him out sooner rather than later. When that befell, his own successor would be a Hightower, the king assured Lord Donald, provided his kin aligned themselves firmly with the exceptionalists during Septon Alfin's reign. Thus was the bargain struck, if Septon Barth's account can be believed. Barth himself did not question it, though he rued the corruption that made the most devout so easy to manipulate. It would be better if the 7 themselves would choose their voice on earth, but when the gods are silent, lords and kings will make themselves heard, he wrote, and added that both Alfin and Lord Donald's brother, who succeeded him, were more worthy of the crystal crown than Septon Mateus could ever have been. No one was more astonished by the selection of Septon Alfin than Septon Alfin himself, who was at Ashford when word reached him. Travelling by litter, it took him more than a fortnight to reach Oldtown. Whilst awaiting his coming, Jaehaerys used the time to call at Bandallan, Three Towers, Uplands, and Honeyholt. He even flew Vermithor to the Arbor, where he sampled some of that island's choicest wines. Queen Alysanne remained in Oldtown. The Silent Sisters hosted her in their mother house for a day of prayer and contemplation. Another day she spent with the Septors, who cared for the city's sick and destitute. Amongst the novices she met was her niece, Rayla, whom Her Grace pronounced a learned and devout young woman, though much given to stammers and blushes. For 3 days she lost herself in the Citadel's great library, emerging only to attend lectures on the Valyrian Dragon Wars, leechcraft, and the gods of the Summer Isles. Afterwards she feasted the assembled archmaesters in their own dining hall, and even presumed to lecture them. "If I had not become queen, I might have liked to be a maester," she told the conclave. "I read, I write, I think. I am not afraid of ravens, or a bit of blood. There are other high-born girls who feel the same. Why not admit them to your citadel? If they cannot keep up, send them home, the way you send home boys who are not clever enough. If you would give the girls a chance, you might be surprised by how many forge a chain." The archmaesters, loath to gainsay the queen, smiled at her words, and bobbed their heads and assured Her Grace that they would consider her proposal. Once the new High Septon reached Oldtown, stood his vigil in the Starry Sept, and had been duly anointed and consecrated to the 7, forsaking his earthly name and all earthly ties, he blessed King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne at a solemn public ceremony. The King's Guard and a company of retainers had joined the King and Queen as well by that point, so His Grace decided to return by way of the Dornish Marches and the Stormlands. Visits at Hornhill, Nightsong, and Blackhaven followed. Queen Alysanne found the last especially congenial. Though his castle was small and modest, compared to the great halls of the realm, Lord Dondarrion was a splendid host, and his son Simon played the high harp as well as he jousted, and entertained the royal couple by night with sad songs of star-crossed lovers and the fall of kings. So taken with him was the queen that the party lingered longer at Blackhaven than they had intended. They were still there when a raven reached them from Storm's End with dire tidings. Their mother, Queen Alysa, was at the point of death. Once more, Vermithor and Silverwing took to the skies to bring the king and queen to their mother's side as quickly as possible. The remainder of the royal party would follow overland by way of Stoneholm, Crow's Nest and Griffin's Roost, under the command of Sir Giles Morrigan, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. The great Baratheon stronghold of Storm's End has but a single tower, the massive Drum Tower raised by Durin Godsgrief during the Age of Heroes to stand against the wrath of the Storm God. At the top of that tower, beneath only the maester's cell and the rookery, Alisanne and Jaehaerys found their mother asleep in a bed that stank of urine, drenched in sweat and gaunt as a crone, save for her swollen belly. A maester, a midwife, and three bedmaids were in attendance on her, each grimmer than the last. Jaehaerys discovered Lord Rhaegar seated outside the chamber door, drunk and despairing. When the king demanded to know why he was not with his wife, the Lord of Storm's End growled, "The stranger's in that room. I can smell him." A cup of wine tinged with sweet sleep was all that allowed Queen Alyssa even this brief respite, Maester Ciri explained. Alyssa had been in agony for some hours before. "She was screaming so," one of the servants added. "Every bit of food we give her comes back up, and she's having awful pain." "She was not due," Queen Alysanne said in tears. "Not yet." "Not for a moon's turn," confirmed the midwife. "This is no labour, my lords. Something's tore inside her. Babe's dying or will be dead soon. The mother's too old. She's no strength to push, and the babe's twisted around. It's no good. They'll be gone by first light, both of them. Begging your pardons?" Maester Ciri did not disagree. Milk of the poppy would relieve the queen's pain, he said, and he had a strong draught prepared. But it could kill her grace as easily as help her, and would almost certainly kill the child inside her. When Jaehaerys asked what could be done, the maester said, "For the queen? Nothing. She is beyond my power to save. There is a chance, a slight chance, that I could save the child. To do so I would need to cut the mother open and remove the child from her womb. The babe might live or not. The woman will die." His words set Queen Alysanne to weeping. The king said only, "The woman is my mother, and a queen," in a heavy tone. He stepped outside again, pulled Rhaegar Baratheon to his feet and dragged him back into the birthing chamber, where he bade the maester repeat what he had just said. "She is your wife," King Jaehaerys reminded Lord Rhaegar. "It is for you to say the words." Lord Rhaegar, we are told, could not bear to look upon his wife. Nor could he find the words, until the king took him roughly by the arm and shook him. "Save my son," Rhaegar told the maester. Then he wrenched free and fled the room again. Maester Ciri bowed his head and sent for his blade. In many of the accounts that have come down to us, we are told that Queen Alyssa woke from her sleep before the maester could begin. Though racked by pain and violent convulsions, she cried tears of joy to see her children there. When Alysanne told her what was about to happen, Alyssa gave her assent. "Save my babe," she whispered. "I will go to see my boys again. The crone will light my way." It is pleasant to believe these were the queen's last words. Sad to say, other accounts tell us that her grace died without waking when Maester Ciri opened her belly. On one point, all agree. Alysanne held her mother's hand in her own, from start to finish, until the babe's first squall filled the room. Lord Rhaegar did not get the second son that he had prayed for. The child was a girl, born so small and weak that midwife and maester alike did not believe she would survive. She surprised them both, as she would surprise many others in her time. Days later, when he had finally recovered himself enough to consider the matter, Rhaegar Baratheon named his daughter Jocelyn. First, however, his lordship had to contend with a more contentious arrival. Dawn was breaking, and Queen Alyssa's body was not yet cold, when Vermithor raised his head from where he had been coiled, sleeping in the yard, and gave out with a roar that woke half of Storm's End. He had scented the approach of another dragon. Moments later, Dreamfire descended, silver crests flashing along her back as her pale blue wings beat against the red dawn sky. Rhaena Targaryen had come to make amends to her mother. She came too late. Queen Alyssa was gone. Though the king told her she did not need to look upon her mother's mortal remains, Reyna insisted, ripping away the bedclothes that covered her to gaze upon the maester's work. After a long time she turned away to kiss her brother on the cheek and embrace her younger sister. The two queens held each other for a long while, it is said, but when the midwife offered Reyna the newborn babe to hold, she refused. "Where is Rogar?" she asked. She found him below in his great hall with his young son Boromund in his lap, surrounded by his brothers and his knights. Reyna Targaryen pushed through all of them to stand over him, and began to curse him to his face. "Her blood is on your hands," she raged at him. "Her blood is on your cock. May you die screaming." Rogar Baratheon was outraged by her accusations. "What are you saying, woman? This is the will of the gods. The stranger comes for all of us. How could it be my doing? What did I do?" "You put your cock in her. She gave you one son. That should have been enough. Save my wife, you should have said. But what are wives to men like you?" Reyna reached out and grabbed his beard and pulled his face to hers. "Hear this, my lord. Do not think to wed again. Take care of the whelps my mother gave you, my half-brother and half-sister. See that they want for nothing. Do that, and I will let you be. If I should hear even a whisper of your taking some other poor maid to wife, I will make another Harrenhal of Storm's End, with you and her inside it." When she had stormed from the hall, back to her dragon in the yard, Lord Rogar and his brothers shared a laugh. "She is mad," he declared. "Does she think to frighten me? Me? I did not fear the wrath of Maegor the Cruel. Should I fear hers?" Thereafter he drank a cup of wine, summoned his steward to make arrangements for his wife's burial, and sent his brother Sir Garen to invite the king and queen to stay on for a feast in honour of his daughter. Rogar Baratheon never wed again. It was a sadder king who returned to King's Landing from Storm's End. The most devout had given him the high septon he desired. The doctrine of exceptionalism would be a tenet of the faith, and he had reached an accord with the powerful Hightowers of Old Town. But these victories had turned to ashes in his mouth with the death of his mother. Jaehaerys was not one to brood, however. As he would do so often during his long reign, the king shrugged off his sorrows and plunged himself into the ruling of his realm. Summer had given way to autumn, and leaves were falling all across the Seven Kingdoms. A new Vulture King had emerged in the Red Mountains. The sweating sickness had broken out on the Three Sisters, and Tyrosh and Lys were edging toward a war that would almost certainly engulf the Stepstones and disrupt trade. All this must needs be dealt with, and deal with it he did. Queen Alysanne found a different answer. Having lost a mother, she found solace in a daughter. Though not quite a year and a half old, Princess Daenerys had been talking, after a fashion, since well before her first name day, and had gone past crawling, lurching, and walking into running. "She is in a great hurry, this one," her wet nurse told the queen. The little princess was a happy child, endlessly curious and utterly fearless, a delight to all who knew her. She so enchanted Alysanne that for a time Her Grace even began to eschew council sessions, preferring to spend her days playing with her daughter, and reading her the stories that her own mother had once read to her. "She is so clever, she will be reading to me before long," she told the king. "She is going to be a great queen, I know it." The stranger was not yet done with House Targaryen in that cruel year of 54 AC, however. Across Blackwater Bay on Dragonstone, Rhaena Targaryen had found new griefs awaiting her when she returned from Storm's End. Far from being a joy and a comfort to her, as Daenerys was to Alysanne, her own daughter Arya had become a terror, a willful, wild child who defied her scepter, her mother and her maesters alike, abused her servants, absented herself from prayers, lessons, and meals without leave, and addressed the men and women of Rhaena's court with such charming names as Sir Stupid, Lord Pigface, and Lady Farts-a-Lot. Her Grace's husband, Andrew Farman, though less vocal and openly defiant, was no less angry. When word first reached Dragonstone that Queen Alyssa was failing, Andrew had announced that he would accompany his wife to Storm's End. As her husband, he said, his place was at Rhaenyra's side, to give her comfort. The Queen had refused him, however, and not gently. A loud argument had preceded her departure, and Her Grace was heard to say, "The wrong Farman ran away." Her marriage, never passionate, had become a mummer's farce by 54 AC. "And not an entertaining one," Lady Elaine Royce observed. Andrew Farman was no longer the lad that Rhaenyra had married 5 years earlier on Fair Isle when he was 10 and 7. The comely stripling had become puffy-faced, round-shouldered and fleshy. Never well-regarded by other men, he had found himself forgotten and ignored by their lordly hosts during Rhaenyra's wanderings in the West. Dragonstone proved to be no better. His wife was still a queen, but no one mistook Andrew for a king, or even a lord consort. Though he sat at Queen Rhaenyra's side during meals, he did not share her bed. That honour went to her friends and favourites. His own bedchamber was in an altogether different tower from hers. The gossips at court said the queen told him that it was better that they slept apart, so he need not be disturbed if he should find some pretty maid to warm his bed. There is no indication that he ever did. His days were as empty as his nights. Though he had been born upon an island and now lived upon another, Andrew did not sail or swim or fish. A failed squire, he had no skill with sword, nor axe, nor spear, so when the men of the castle garrison trained each morning in the yard, he kept to his bed. Thinking that he might be of a bookish disposition, Maester Culliper tried to interest him in the treasures of Dragonstone's library, the ponderous tomes and old Valyrian scrolls that had fascinated King Jaehaerys, only to discover that the queen's husband could not read. Andrew rode passably well, and from time to time would have a horse saddled so he might trot about the yard. But he never passed beyond the gates to explore the Dragonmont's rocky paths or the far side of the island, nor even the fishing village and docks beneath the castle. "He drinks a deal," Maester Culliper wrote to the Citadel, "and has been known to spend entire days in the chamber of the Painted Table, moving painted wooden soldiers about the map. Queen Rhaenyra's companions are wont to say he is planning his conquest of Westeros. They do not mock him to his face for her sake, but they titter at him behind his back. The knights and men-at-arms pay him no mind whatsoever, and the servants obey him, or not, as they please, with no fear of his displeasure. The children are the cruelest, as children often are, and none half so cruel as the Princess Arya. She once emptied a chamber-pot upon his head, not for anything he did, but because she was wroth with her mother." Andrew Farman's discontent on Dragonstone only grew worse after his sister's departure. Lady Alyssa had been his closest friend, mayhaps his only friend, Culliper observed, and despite his tearful denials, Rhaenyra found it hard to accept that he had played no role in the matter of her dragon eggs. When the Queen dismissed Sir Meryl Bullock, Andrew had asked her to appoint him commander of the castle garrison in Bullock's place. Her Grace had been breaking her fast with 4 of her ladies-in-waiting at the time. The women burst into laughter at his request, and after a moment the Queen had laughed as well. When Rhaenyra flew to King's Landing to inform King Jaehaerys of the theft, Andrew had offered to accompany her. His wife refused him scornfully. "What would that serve? What could you possibly do but fall off the dragon?" Queen Rhaenyra's denial of his wish to go with her to Storm's End was but the latest and the last in a long string of humiliations for Andrew Farman. By the time Rhaenyra returned from her mother's deathbed, he was well past any desire to comfort her. Sullen and cold, he sat silent at meals and avoided the Queen's company elsewise. If Rhaenyra Targaryen was troubled by his sulks, she gave little sign of it. She found consolation in her ladies instead, in old friends like Samantha Stokeworth and Elaine Royce, and newer companions like her cousin Lyanna Valerian, Lord Staunton's pretty daughter Casella, and young Septa Mariam. Whatever peace they helped her find proved short-lived. Autumn had come to Dragonstone, as to the rest of Westeros, and with it came cold winds from the north and storms from the south raging up the narrow sea. A darkness settled over the ancient fortress, a gloomy place even in summer. Even the dragons